Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Gadelstrom. Wyoming Public Radio asked our listeners to share with us how they're impacted by the latest orders by the Trump administration. Messages streamed in.
I felt like the ground had been ripped out from under me. I had done everything I could.
We'll hear from a few of those. It's been 3 years since the war in Ukraine started. We check in with a Laramie pediatrician who has gone to the country 3 times.
I know people over there. It's now personal.
Paleontologists discovered the fossils of the oldest known dinosaur in North America outside of Du Bois. It's also the first dino to be named in Shoshone.
As long as things are done respectfully, I think our two worlds can help each other.
And we'll have an update on the legislature with the Cheyenne Roundup. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. The Trump administration is moving quickly to reduce the government workforce. Many in Wyoming are affected by the layoffs. This became clear on Valentine's Day, when the National Park Service, National Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management let many employees go. Wyoming Public Radio asked our listeners to share with us how they're impacted by the latest orders from the Trump administration and how they think this will impact the cowboy state. Messages streamed in. They're worried about losing employee housing, being able to find work in Wyoming, and what this all means for public lands and their communities. We'll hear 3 of those voices.
My name is Stephanie Flinders. I work for the Forest Service, and my duty station was in Mountain View, Wyoming. I learned I was terminated on Sunday the 16th. I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I ran in my room crying so that they didn't see me because I didn't know what I was going to do. I live in the middle of nowhere with few employment opportunities as it is. And as a single mom, I was completely terrified. I felt like the ground had been ripped out from under me. I had done everything I could to prove myself indispensable to my district, my forest, I thought my country. I was in total shock. I no longer have benefits, I no longer have health insurance. I'm scared sick because I can't just relocate and find other employment because, you know, as well as I get along with my ex, relocating would mean a whole new negotiation as far as parenting, and this limits complete access to my children. I was in charge of all non-motorized, motorized, and cross-country trails along the north slope of the Uinta Range. There's over 700 miles of just non-motorized trail. I was in charge of clearing, maintaining those. I also was in charge of wilderness management and conservation. So these trails are going to become inaccessible. I know that everyone that's still there are panicking because they can't do what they've even been asked to do. Not possible to accomplish what the public asks and demands. And I feel like the public ought to know. It's tragic for those that enjoy the mountains, and it's tragic for the mountains themselves.
My name is Richard Midget. I am 28 years old. I live in Gardner, Montana. And I worked as an IT specialist for Yellowstone National Park. We have a lot of key projects that I can't speak of in terms of modernizing Yellowstone's communications and network infrastructure that might be delayed or put on the back burner due to funding and staffing concerns. Well, it started a week before I was actually let go. It was on February 5th. My boss had called me into an office with his boss and informed me, as well as other probationary employees and colleagues of mine that they were demanded to provide a list of all probationary employees, their job status, role, and also explanation of what I do and why I should not be fired, basically. The day before Valentine's Day, my boss had called me about 10 minutes after my shift ended to inform me that they had been sent an email, essentially warning us of termination within 24 hours. That within the next 24 hours, I would potentially lose my employment. And so I had to go to sleep that night and only got 3 hours of sleep. And had to go to work that morning, on Friday morning on Valentine's, knowing that at any moment in the day, I could receive an email effectively terminating my employment. I went in and did my job as normal. My boss came in around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon to let me know he had received an email terminating my position and that I was to clear out my desk and the termination would be effective by end of day. Everyone's afraid of their jobs, even if they've been working there for years and are well beyond their probationary period, even if they've received nothing but exceptional or fully successful performance reviews. People are scared that their job is no longer stable. It's a job that they've done for years. My fear with this is that they are going to defund our land agencies because they're seeing so many, you know, poor performance related to now being understaffed so severely that they're not being able to fully meet all the goals that are expected of them. And if the remaining employees now cannot fully perform their job duties effectively, then they will use that to go back and say, look, they're not doing their job correctly. Let's now fire them as well. And then there's nobody staffing our public lands.
We finish with a remote employee of the Department of Energy who lives in Wyoming. He asked to be anonymous because he still has his job.
The reason I want to stay anonymous is the fear for repercussions from the government, really, mostly, and protecting my future. I mean, that's ultimately what it is. I've only been with the DOE for a little over a year. I switched recently. I worked for the Bureau of Land Management for about 13 years. And so when this opportunity came up to be remote, because I am ingrained in this community, and I have a 6-year-old daughter and married and we have family here. So being able to, you know, advance my career remotely was a big deal for me. As a NEPA specialist, we review projects from various programs. Some are solar, hydrogen, building technologies, energy efficiency, geothermal. So when the grants are issued, we comply with the National Environmental Policy Act. You know, it started on inauguration day with the executive orders, and return to office was one of the first ones that came through. So that kind of set in panic or disappointment. Then all the probationary and reduction in force executive orders were signed. And so then you're wondering whether some of the people that are on your team are going to get fired or if you're going to. We can't sign documents. And up until about a week ago, we were not allowed to communicate externally. So we couldn't even really work on the projects. There's no finishing projects right now. We don't have the ability to. That ability has been stripped by the administration. And I don't know what that means for me. I haven't got an official date yet, but it's coming. I'll leave the federal service. I will not be working for the DOE anymore. And that, it's heartbreaking. I mean, I think I'm only about a week short of 14 years in federal service. Thank you.
were the voices of three federal employees who have been impacted by the federal layoffs, telling their stories. This story was reported by Caitlin Tan, Olivia Wietz, and Hannah Merzbach. I want to bring in our reporters, Caitlin Tan and Olivia Wietz, who've been reporting on the number and types of federal worker cuts here in Wyoming. There have been a lot of numbers floating around about how many federal employees have been laid off. So before we get into what's happening here in Wyoming, why are these numbers so hard to get? With the caveat that this continues to be fast-moving news. So we're talking about what we've been able to find as of February 21st. Caitlin?
Yeah, you know, Camila, it's been hard to confirm anything. Instead of getting responses from our local forests and national parks, we're being sent to DC offices that don't always respond. And then workers themselves, even in supporting organizations that aren't federal, they're scared to talk. We even posted an anonymous form on our website asking folks to get in touch with how they've been affected. People are scared to even fill out that anonymous form. One source wouldn't even text me. He was scared of having a paper trail. He'd only do phone calls.
Wow. And Olivia, you spoke with someone who works for a partner organization for the National Park Service. Can you let us know what she shared with you?
I spoke with Michelle Ubaraga with the National Parks Conservation Association, an advocacy group with 1.6 million members. She says she's hearing 7 full-time Yellowstone National Park positions were cut. And for context, Yellowstone employs about 308 full-time year-round workers. She declined to share how she's been learning these firing numbers. She says positions cut were within IT, the Yellowstone Center for Resources office. They deal with everything from archaeological sites to monitoring for invasive aquatic species, and the Wildlife Division, among other departments. Now, Wyoming Public Media could not independently verify Ubaraga's numbers or the positions she mentioned. I sent an email to Yellowstone National Park and the National Park Service asking to confirm or update the numbers and the types of positions, but as of press time, have not heard a response.
Okay, thank you. And Caitlin, you've been hearing from fired Forest Service employees, right?
Yeah. So in Wyoming, I've heard from 2 fired employees from the Bridger-Teton National Forest that at least 40 people were cut in the first round of firings. That was up until Tuesday. It may be more since then. And now presumably all 8 forests and all the BLM offices in the state were affected as the firings were targeted at probationary employees. And, you know, these are mostly employees in their first year, but it could also be someone who, say, you know, got a promotion with a new job title, who's now again under a probationary period. I'm hearing stories of people getting letters saying it's not in the public interest to keep you employed. And it actually took several emails to local and federal agencies to try to confirm what we've been hearing on and off the record. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service, they said in an email that 2,000 probationary workers had been laid off. But I also spoke with Dennis Lapsiewicz. He's with the Forest Service Council, a national union. And he said that 3,400 Forest Service workers across the nation were fired as of Valentine's Day.
I heard from Governor Mark Gordon's office on Thursday that without firm details or numbers, it's difficult to speculate on the impacts in Wyoming, but that Governor Gordon is sympathetic to all Wyomingites who have lost their jobs. So what do these workers and organizations say is at stake with all these firings? Olivia, let's start with Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah, so with Yellowstone, Ubaraga says that really all the Yellowstone positions that were cut are important to how the park functions.
We lost folks from maintenance and facilities, and those are critical positions that make sure Yellowstone has infrastructure, clean water, wastewater treatment.
At the current staffing levels, she says people are already performing additional duties.
We're going to see potentially shorter visitor center hours, delayed openings, closed campgrounds, maintenance needs will grow, trash will pile up, restrooms will go unclean, and worst case, public safety could be at risk.
Caitlin?
So I spoke with Hillary Eisen. She's with the Winter Wildlands Alliance. They're a national nonprofit that advocates for public lands. And she called it a tsunami of impact. It's really unprecedented. You know, people are still going to show up for vacation this summer.
There will be no trail crew. There will be nobody to clean the outhouses, to pick up trash, to put out campfires so that they don't turn into giant wildfires. Like, it's just mind-boggling how stupid it is.
Eisen says last year, the Forest Service tried to transition a lot of seasonal workers into permanent positions.
Which was an exciting thing. People had reliable employment, but they are technically in their probationary period. So they were all just fired.
So there has been fear that basic public services like trail maintenance and toilet cleanings won't get done because there will be no staff to do them. What have agencies or the Trump administration said to that? Olivia?
I emailed the National Park Service asking them to verify the number of firings at Yellowstone and which positions were impacted. I didn't hear back by press time.
The USDA says the Forest Service firings is an attempt to, quote, better service American farmers, ranchers, loggers, and the agriculture community, unquote. But Eisen with Winter Wildlands says some of those people cut oversee permits and contracts that farmers, ranchers, and loggers need.
They're going to have less time to devote to working with the local rancher on his grazing permit.
The USDA also said that none of the firings were operational firefighters. But again, I've heard from sources that that's not quite the case. A lot of Forest Service workers in other jobs still have their red card certifications, which allows them to fight fire during the peak of the season. Here's Forest Service Counsel's Dennis Lapsiewicz.
They're being fired. So we are losing wildland firefighters right and left, and they're not going to be here come this fire season.
I've also heard some of the workers cut were in fuels reduction positions meant to help prevent those out-of-control blazes.
I emailed several of Wyoming's top elected officials to get a sense of what they make of this moment. Both Senator Cynthia Lummis and John Barrasso replied saying they fully support President Trump and DOGE's effort to reduce federal spending. Both said that they are working to make sure programs critical in Wyoming, national parks, and federal lands are protected. Barrasso said he's committed to making sure any communities in Wyoming impacted by proposed cuts, including our university and community colleges, have a seat at that table. And Representative Harriet Hageman said the administration's efforts will provide long-term financial relief and benefit for all Wyomingites. Okay, so Olivia, Caitlin, any last thoughts?
Everyone we've talked to is expecting more cuts. And of course, we haven't even touched on the other federal agencies in the state.
I want to point out that this is impacting other areas in the state like research, grants, Veterans Affairs, and many others.
We do plan to have more reporting on that as we learn more. So thank you, Wyoming Public Media's Caitlin Tan and Olivia Wheats, reporting on what we know about how the federal firings are impacting Wyomingites. A Laramie doctor has been to Ukraine 3 times since the war started. We check in with him. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Part of why I love Wyoming Public Radio is because it is probably the last remaining really truly valid radio format here in the U.S. because it still provides really valid content that you can't get anywhere else.
I love Wyoming Public Radio. It's just important.
Help celebrate I Love Wyoming Public Radio Week by clicking the I Love Wyoming Public Radio icon at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can access listener testimonials and find out how to record your own. Just look for I Love Wyoming Public Radio at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. When Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine about 3 years ago, people around the world were moved by the stories and images coming out of Eastern Europe. Among them was Dr. Kent Kleppinger, a pediatrician from Laramie. He felt compelled to lend a hand, despite having no personal connection to Ukraine. He's now been to the war-torn region 3 separate times, helping out at Children's Hospital in Kyiv. Kleppinger spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor about what it's like getting involved with the war on the other side of the world.
How soon did you decide that you needed to go there?
I remember seeing
images on the news of mothers with children in their arms running for their lives. And that was the image that stuck. Sure, they showed some war footage, and that was terrible too. But all of these people were literally running for their lives, and something just snapped. And it's one of those moments where you have two voices that are supposed to pop up. One that says, go do something. And then about 2 seconds later, a second voice pops up and says, are you crazy? You know, you're not thinking this through. Stop and think. Calm down. That voice never showed up. Literally.
Never.
And so I just literally had this voice saying, you need to go do something. And nothing on the other side trying to stop me. And then I did the craziest thing I've ever done in my life. I Googled the Ukraine government. And I found the Ministry of Health and a phone number. And sure as heck, somebody answers the phone. And I'm talking in English. They're talking in Ukrainian. I don't understand. I don't speak Ukrainian. And the phone goes silent. I went, oh, no, I'm cut off. And all of a sudden, this man is on the phone speaking in perfect English, and it's the assistant minister of health talking to me. And I'm saying, I want to come over and help. How can I get there? He goes, just come. So I made copies of things like my medical diploma, my medical license, and all those kind of papers, and put them on a thumb drive and packed a bag, flew to Warsaw. You have to take a train into Kiev. You obviously can't fly. You'll be shot down.
Were you mostly doing standard checkups? Like, what did they have you doing when you were there?
I saw everything. Some acute illnesses. I saw some follow-ups of chronic illnesses. Some people brought their child in just for a physical. And so it was just a variety of things. I saw heart murmurs and kids who had respiratory illnesses and asthma and stuff like that.
What's it like doing work in a war-torn country?
The actual war is happening. I mean, the front is about the same distance away as southern Denver or Colorado Springs. So yes, you're in the area, but you're not on the front. But at the same time, there's still Russia shooting missiles all the time into cities all over Ukraine, all the way to the west side. So just about every night, sirens go off, and they actually have an app that you download on the phone giving you about a 20-minute warning that rockets are on their way to where you're located, and you have that much time to find shelter.
Wow.
The first night I was there on the second trip, about 8 o'clock at night, and I went down to Independence Square just to see people. And I look up in the sky, and I see poof, 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 five of them. And I went, oh, God, we just shot down some missiles. How cool. And I thought, holy crap, they were firing missiles at us. Maybe I shouldn't be out here. And everybody was calm and just going about their business and walking around on the streets. And I thought, if I see them running for the subway entrance, I'll go with them.
That's wild that you can actually see it. And also that clearly everyone there knows when it's a threat,
yeah,
when it's not.
Well, kind of. A lot of the people are so conditioned to missile attacks now that even though the missile attacks are coming, and even though you or I would seek shelter, they've taken on this attitude. It's like, well, I've made it this far. I'll be okay. I think they get a sense of false security about it. The weird fact is, having never served in the military or been in a war of any kind, you have this odd understanding of what war's like. War's for them, not for me. It's over there, not here. And so you kind of turn into this odd spectator standing watching it happen but not being in it.
Do you feel less like a spectator now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have really close friends in Kiev. I have some friends in Poltava, in Odessa, and some of the other cities that are being, you know, shelled every night. And so I still have the app going on my phone, and I have their cities listed, and you know, a couple times I'll contact them after they've had air raids and make sure they're safe and doing well. But yes, I know people over there. It's now personal.
Having that connection, is it hard to be here, to be so away from it?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've done what I set out to do over there. And even if I don't go back into Ukraine next summer, if the war ended tomorrow, I've told all the family, I will take them over to Ukraine and we'll tour the country and just look at its history and how beautiful a country it is.
Reports from this fall put the number of dead and injured from both sides at over 1 million, with another 12,000 civilian deaths. The war might not end anytime soon.
No.
So what's next for you?
I don't know. I mean, this isn't something where I'm campaigning to go look for the next war and go jump into an area like Palestine or Sudan or something. Literally, this hooked me in a way that I wasn't expecting to have happen. People go, why should we care? Russia's president, Putin, dictator Putin, has said that if he can beat Ukraine, he will erase it as a country, as a language, as a culture, and it won't exist. We shouldn't let a dictator jump in and erase an entire country. So I would hope this country can stay firm in their support for this war. They want aid. They don't want us to come in and do their fighting for them. They want to be a free and unique people and to exist. And we should help them do it without reservation.
Well, Dr. Clevenger, thanks for talking with me today.
No problem.
Stay with us. Up next is our weekly Wyoming Legislature Roundup. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, I speak with Leela Philip, author of the book Beaverland: How One Weird Rodent Made America.
Encountering the beavers was really serendipity. I was taking a walk with my dog and I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention. And next thing I knew, there was this bam, like a gun had gone off. It was the iconic beaver tail slam.
I'm Megan Feary. Look for a brand new Human Nature episode December 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. This winter, Wyoming Public Radio is teaming up with WildFile to bring you weekly updates from the legislative session. It's called the Cheyenne Roundup, and you can hear it here in just a moment or wherever you get your podcast.
This is the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and WildFile. I'm Maggie Mullen, WildFile's state government and politics reporter, and with me is Chris Clements, Wyoming Public Radio's state house reporter.
Hey, hey, hey.
This week, as bills start to head to the governor's desk, we want to dig into a story you reported, Chris, on how the volume of legislation might be shaping policy.
Yeah, a whopping 555 bills were drafted this session. In my reporting, I went through past news releases and bill lists from the legislature and found that's the most in the last 24 years.
In the House alone, there were 347 bills. More than half came from Freedom Caucus-aligned lawmakers who hold the majority of seats in the House. The remaining were a mix of committee bills or sponsored by lawmakers not affiliated with the Freedom Caucus.
And at the national level, in President Trump's first 100 days, he signed the most executive orders of any president in the last 40 years. At the same time, in my job as a reporter covering our state's government, I started to pick up on a pattern here in Wyoming that seems akin to what's happening within the Trump administration. There's a lot of bills filed for introduction this session that you might call unprecedented for one reason or another, and a lot of bills that could tie up our judicial branch if they ever make it to the light at the end of the tunnel. Whether this is as deliberate a strategy at the state level isn't fully clear, but it's something I've been asking about when I talk to lawmakers and lobbyists.
In my experience, bills have always outnumbered the press corps at the Capitol, but I will say that this session has felt fast and furious in a different way.
It's not just the number of bills, but also the kinds of bills. We're hearing from listeners, there's a real sense of fatigue in reading so many headlines that have to do with these controversial culture war issues. People just want to tune out. It's putting a strain on activists, advocates, and even the Legislative Service Office. The LSO received 800 bill draft requests from legislators this session for an initial legal review, a high water mark in terms of bills that have been sent to them from electeds, at least in the last 15 years.
And a lot of bills overlap with one another, so bills will often end up competing with one another.
Jessie Rubino says that is a good thing. She's the Wyoming State Director for the State Freedom Caucus Network, which is based in Washington, D.C. The network's leader has told news outlets in other states that it wants to expose what they call fake Republicans by pushing further right conservative policies. Rubino says that this session, similar to previous ones, she's emailing members suggestions on how to vote.
I read every single bill that's been filed in the legislature. I provide a summary and an in-depth analysis from a liberty and constitutional perspective to the members.
Bill summaries and recommendations are not uncommon on either side of the aisle or from lobbyists, but something interesting Rubino told me had to do with where Freedom Caucus members get their legislative inspiration from, in addition to hearing from constituents.
I would say that the shared faith in Jesus amongst the Freedom Caucus and our conservative allies in the Wyoming House and Senate doesn't just drive the legislative priorities that the members have, it drives everything that they do.
Christianity has definitely been more pronounced at the State House this year, but let's get back to the volume of bills this session.
Yeah, so Rubino told me she thinks it could be more effective for the Freedom Caucus.
In the marketplace of ideas, the more ideas are better because in the end, the best ideas will win out. And so the more bills there are, the more there is to work with, including if there are multiple vehicles to achieve the same policy goal. We see that with multiple ESG bills being introduced, one on the House side, a couple on the Senate side. And I think conservatives and Freedom Caucus members welcome the high number of bills for that reason.
At the end of the day, the Freedom Caucus holds the majority in the House, and they also decide which bills get heard and which end up languishing in the Speaker's drawer, like we talked about a couple of shows back. The Speaker unilaterally halted about a quarter of all House bills. All to say, the caucus has the last say in the House.
Rubino's point is that more bills means more policy ideas in play and more chances for at least some of them to advance, and we're definitely seeing that on some issues. For example, 9 bills having to do with the trans community were introduced this session compared to 2 in 2023. Bills centered on abortion went from 5 in 2023 to 8 in 2025. 2 years ago, we saw abortion bills like the Life is a Human Right Act, which was struck down by a district judge last year, and a ban on medication abortion. This year, we've got bills aiming to reach a similar end result in Wyoming, which is preventing abortions. The vehicles for doing that are a little different this year, but the goal is the same. Cody Representative and Freedom Caucus Chair Rachel Rodriguez-Williams laid the strategy out for me in advance of the session.
I would say as a member of the pro-life caucus in the Wyoming legislature, that right now everything is on the table.
But not everybody agrees it's good governance just to put everything on the table. Is that right?
I'd say so. So I wanted some perspective on that from a longtime lawmaker who's seen the rise of the Freedom Caucus in recent sessions. So I reached out to former Rock Springs Representative Clark Stith. He was part of the more moderate Wyoming caucus of the GOP. Here he is talking about some of the immigration and abortion bills.
By having several of these relatively extreme bills, it perhaps dilutes the focus on any one of them.
Another former longtime moderate Republican lawmaker, Dan Zwanitzer of Cheyenne, told me that filing so many bills ultimately isn't effective.
Yeah, I guess you got some good press out of it, but you have some bad policy that the Senate will have to amend and fix.
I didn't encounter any sitting lawmakers, Freedom Caucus or otherwise, that said the high number of bills was any kind of intentional strategy. What I found was there are a lot of new lawmakers eager to bring ideas to the table and returning members bringing bills back that failed in past sessions. But one area where we saw a really high volume of bills with a decent bit of overlap was legislation to overhaul the state's elections. So lawmakers filed 45 election-related bills this session. And if that sounds like a lot, it's because it is. Those bills accounted for 8% of all legislation in both the House and the Senate this year. And they run the gamut. Some would put new restrictions on the voter registration process. One would prohibit ballot drop boxes. Another would curtail the use of student IDs and Medicaid and Medicare insurance cards as acceptable forms of voter identification.
What's been the effect of having so many election bills?
For one, we saw House leadership assigning those bills to committees that don't usually deal with election legislation because the House Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions Committee was simply overwhelmed. I'll also mention that most election bills came out of the House and were brought by Freedom Caucus members. Democrats and non-Freedom Caucus members, for the most part, have a different perspective on what needs fixing when it comes to elections. Casper Republican Senator Bill Landon made this point as lawmakers discussed a resolution asking Congress to propose a constitutional amendment. It would allow states to establish limits on political contributions. Here, Landon is talking about dark money being the real problem.
It's interesting during this session that we're spending countless hours on the security of our elections. And it's all about, you know, tightening up where you can go and how you can fill out your ballot and where you can't throw it in a box or whatever. But this actually, in my opinion, this kind of activity threatens the security of our elections here in Wyoming, when you really come right down to it.
You can read more about that legislation in my election bill roundup story at wildfile.com.
There's another way all these bills might factor into future elections, and that is as fodder for the campaign trail. University of Wyoming professor Ryan Williamson explains.
Political science has kind of well documented the fact that oftentimes it's the position on an issue that is a more valuable commodity than, you know, the actual policy outcome. The ability to say, you know, to your supporters, your constituency, your party, you know, we're fighting the quote unquote good fight. That's more important than whether or not a bill passes in the minds of many people.
Even if lots of bills meet their demise, Williamson said, the high volume makes it more likely at least some will cross the finish line.
So switching gears now, let's talk about bills heading to the governor's desk.
Yeah, not too long ago, Gordon shared a news release detailing how he's going to consider which bills to sign and which ones to veto.
That's right. He laid out a rubric of 5 questions, including, is the bill constitutional? Does it interfere with personal or private property rights? Does it erode local control? Does it grow state government or incur significant ongoing costs to the state? And will it make Wyoming better for our children and grandchildren?
If lawmakers want the chance to override Gordon's vetoes, they'll need to get bills in by February 28th. We're seeing a push for that with a bill to cut property taxes and some of those election bills. But it's unclear to me if everything in the Freedom Caucus's five and dime plan will make it by that deadline.
I followed up with the governor. I was curious if his announcement was about setting expectations, and he sort of confirmed that. He said there's been a lot of discussion at the State House about him needing to prepare, quote, barrels of red ink. But he also said he wanted to remind folks that the legislature makes the laws. Gordon also said he wanted the public to have a reference point where they could have a fuller understanding of this rubric he's using when bills land on his desk.
There are still hurdles, though, for a lot of lawmakers' priority bills. We're expecting another culling on Thursday, when bills need to make it out of committee again. And every subsequent day after that, bills must pass first, second, and third votes by the full chambers. So we're still very much in crunch time. Maggie, what'll you be watching for?
So we spent some time today talking about bills heading to the governor's desk, but we skipped a critical step. Joint conference committees. That's where a bill goes when it passes both the House and the Senate, but the two chambers passed different versions of the bill thanks to amendments. So joint conference committee brings together three representatives and three senators, and they try to reconcile those differences into one unified bill to bring back to both chambers. In particular, I'm eager to watch the supplemental budget bill go through JCC and Senate File 69. That's a property tax cut bill that went through a whole bunch of changes this week in the House. How about you, Chris?
I'll be watching to see if Trump calls out any more of our state House leaders on Truth Social. He did that not too long ago in support of the school vouchers bill, the Wyoming Freedom Scholarship Act, in a post to Senate President Bo Bightman and the whole chamber.
Lots to pay attention to. Thanks for listening to the Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers are up to during the 2025 legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and Wildfile. New episodes drop every Friday throughout the session, editing and producing by Tennessee Watson and Nikki Blett. Follow our ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wildfile.com. And thanks again for listening.
The Cheyenne Roundup will be back on February 28th. You can find it every Friday late afternoon on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, we'll learn about the oldest known dinosaur that was discovered in Wyoming and has a special connection with the Eastern Shoshone tribe. This is Open Spaces.
Join Wyoming Public Radio for a trip around Wyoming. We bring you news from just down the street and across the state four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Hey there, this is Caitlin Tan, Energy and Natural Resources reporter. The Trump administration is taking action to reduce the size of the federal government and the workforce, and we want to hear from you if you work for or with the federal government. Let us know how these changes are affecting you. You can fill out an anonymous form on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, so we can get a clearer picture of what's going on. Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. 12 years ago, a team of paleontologists discovered some fossils outside Du Bois. They spent over a decade analyzing and studying them. Come to find out, they'd found the oldest known dinosaur in North America. Avetenbanduivici lived 230 million years ago. It stood a little taller than a chicken and had a long tail. The team collaborated with members of the Eastern Shoshone tribe to honor the fact that the dino was found on the tribe's ancestral lands. Now, it's the first dinosaur named in the Shoshone language. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talked with Eastern Shoshone elder Reba Jo Taron and University of Wisconsin Geology Museum research scientist Dave Lovelace about the project.
When we were looking for fossils, we started finding some pretty spectacular things right away. We were really excited about it. And we were in the process of writing these stories up for publication. And we realized that a lot of the specimens needed to have new scientific names. It's a pretty traditional scientific methodology. And I was following that. And it was students that were starting to talk to me about, hey, why do we do it this way? And as soon as they start looking at it, I'm like, well, yeah, we're writing in Latin because the people that taught me told me to, but we don't have to. And this is really silly. It's not representative. It's not in any way creating new or sharing information in a different way. I ended up reaching out to the director of Native Relations on the University of Wisconsin campus, and he connected us with the TIPO offices on the Wind River Reservation. And Josh Mann, the TIPO director, hooked us up with the Fort Washakie Schools with Lynette St. Clair, and Lynette brought in Reba, and there was another elder, John Washakie, was in the field with us. And so it was just this process of us talking about it. And so that's kind of the broad story of how we got where we are.
Reba, you've been working on a dictionary of Eastern Shoshone words for a long time. What's that been like, and how did you get involved in this dinosaur project?
Yeah, I was contacted by Lynette St. Clair, and I worked with my sister Beatrice. She's 86 now, like 16 years older than me, but she was fluent. When I was a cultural director in 2002, we started recording our language. Me and Beatrice have been working on it 23 years now, and we've recorded about 24,000 words now. And Manfred sadly passed away, but he was Lynette's brother, but he was fluent. I was working with them, and I was fluent up until I was six. Then you didn't hear it all through school and stuff. As I worked with them, I started to become fluent again, working with it every day and for years, you know. And soon I was dreaming in Shoshone. Then one morning I just snapped and I was speaking and conversational and thinking in it. So that's why I ended up being like an elder in the language, and they consider me a fluent speaker.
Reba, what were you thinking about when you were naming this dinosaur?
Manfred was the one that told us that they called them the Aveitan Banduivici. And Aveit means long ago. You can like Aveit, or you can hold it out, Aveit. Like if you're a storyteller, you'd start out, Aveit. You drag it on for how long it was. Banduivici. Ban means water, and Duivici means young, handsome men. I asked Manfred and him, how come they called them young, handsome men? He said, you think about it, in nature you find like male birds, they're real pretty and bright colors, and like a yellow-headed blackbird will have a real bright yellow head. But the females were kind of drab, like a mallard duck, the female was drab looking. And Creator, the person who made all of us, our people on the earth, he was protecting the females because we're the ones that had the babies and protected the eggs. So the males were the target of hunters. They attracted the attention to protect the females, and that's how Creator made the world.
And Dave, what did this process of bringing people together look like on the ground?
With the Fort Washakie students, we took the seventh grade cohort of 2022 out to the field. And that's where Reba joined us, as well as some of the other educators. We were there to kind of show the students the sites where these animals were found, both the dinosaur and the little amphibian, that both received names in honor in the Shoshone language. That process, just working with the students, was really powerful for me because, you know, we got to tell our story. And this is, as scientists, that's what we do. We go out and we look at things and we make up a story that represents whatever it is that we're observing. But learning and listening to the stories and how Reba especially spoke about being respectful and how to treat the land, this was really powerful for us because it's not something that we had heard before. We took that on and kind of incorporated that information ourselves into how we do field work now, because when we go to new sites, there's been times that other elders have offered to come out to bless the sites, to really just to say some words, and we're trying to show that we're coming with a good intent to tell a story and not just to rip something out of the ground. Because we are violating, you know, the earth when we're going to do this. And if we can understand that we're doing that and try to approach it with a degree of humility and honor and understanding, it has more meaning and impact.
One word that really comes up for me listening to you both is just this idea of reciprocity. What do you hope reciprocity looks like moving forward in this merging of two different ways of knowing?
Reciprocity is a mutual exchange. And I think that that's a powerful thing, and it has been overlooked for far too long. I hope that projects like these are able to move the bar and say, this should be more of the norm.
I know the science part is important. The internet, I've researched birds and stuff. People have studied them, and it takes time. I don't have time to study all the birds or even know what they all look like or how many there are or about their characteristics. But on the internet, I found a site that did have written. So we recorded all of that in our language, totally in Shoshone. It is important to have science, and now with technology helping me, and the work Dave and them are doing. And as long as things are done respectfully, I think our two worlds can help each other.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talking with research scientist Dave Lovelace and Eastern Shoshone elder Reba Jo Taran. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you've heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on our social media platforms. Thank you to Hannah Haberman, our audio producer, Ivy Engel, our digital producer, and Cody Hoom, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.